Good morning, everybody. How is everybody today? Good? Good. All right. So my name is Jim Wunderman. I'm the president and CEO of the Bay Area Council. I know most of you, but for those who I don't know, some of you are associated with the Bay Area Council and our education partners and others with the Commonwealth Club. And this program this morning is brought to you on behalf of our organizations jointly. And the Bay Area Council and the Commonwealth Club have a long history of working together on key issues. So I want to welcome you on behalf of both organizations here this morning and thank you for coming. We have a very robust agenda today. We're talking interesting stuff on obviously a critical issue of the future of education in our state. I apologize if I'm a little bit off my usual sharp self because I just got back very late last night from a week's vacation. You might be able to see the tan. I was the last few days on a boat on Fire Island in New York, and so it was sunny. And when you're on a boat like that, you really can't avoid the sunshine. So I think some of it got to my brain. Most of you probably follow the fact that the Bay Area Council has been leading an effort to talk about the future of the California Constitution and actually promoting a constitutional convention because we think strongly that the state has reached such a point that only a major rebooting of this system is going to do it for us in this point, and it's going to have an effect on everything, including the future of the education system. So I'm not going to get into that too deeply. I was relieved to be in New York where they seem to be having an equal level stalemate to the one we're having in California, so I was a bit relieved to be there. Unfortunately, I did also go through New Jersey, where the roads are very, very smooth, and you know you have beautiful parkways and stuff like that. So I didn't feel as good about New Jersey as I did about New York, where as soon as you get into New York, I thought, okay, I remember roads more like this, much, much better. So we're at a critical point on the Constitutional Convention, and our goal, I'm not going to get into it too deeply, but our goal for that is to have ballot language ready to submit to the Attorney General for title and summary by September 25th. That's the timeline to put the measures on the 2010 ballot that would actually enable the Constitutional Convention to move forward. So it is the summer months, but we have a lot of work ahead of us to really more than just dot the I's and cross the T's, really figure out exactly how to do this in a way that will provide the best results. And so we're at that on a more than a full-time basis, and you're all welcome to check out the website at repaircalifornia.org and sign up, and we encourage everyone's participation in this. This is a true citizens movement, and we welcome your involvement in that. Clearly one of the things, there are many aspects to that, but one of the things that we've been talking about from the beginning is the fact that as we developed the state constitution in recent years, we moved authority and control away from local governments and school districts and brought it to the state government to make key decisions about policy and application of funding and things like that. And that's one of the things that we think a constitutional convention could achieve that would be extremely beneficial is kind of turn the clock back and bring far more relevance and control back to the local communities, which in turn would have people in those local communities who pay the taxes feel that there was a much stronger sense of connection between the dollars that come out of their wallets for services and the services that are actually provided by shifting up to California, the level of Sacramento. We think that that's been really deleterious to that connection over the years, and we'd like to see that turn around. I think that's an issue that probably will get some discussion today. And so, again, a very robust discussion that's coming up. Before we move on with the program, there's actually a very delicious breakfast that I was beginning to partake in over there, and I want to just briefly thank the Swinnerton company for sponsoring the breakfast. And so with that, I want to thank Jeff G. and ask him to come up on behalf of Swinnerton and say a few words. So thank you, Swinnerton.
Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Jeff G. I'm a vice president with Swinnerton Management and Consulting. We are program and construction managers for university schools and colleges. Our passion is education. And while we're not teachers and educators, we are providers of building and design and construction management. And we understand that our role is to be your partner as educators and leaders in the education community to help grow the future of our country and grow the future of our state. So it's a pleasure to be part of the program here at the Bay Area Council this morning. Our commitment is deep throughout the state of California. This is our 121st year based in San Francisco. And we're managing right now about $2 billion worth of school and community college bond funds up and down the state of California, creating great learning environments for our students and leaders of tomorrow. So thank you. Enjoy the program this morning.
Thank you very much, Jeff and Myrna and Swinnerton for sponsoring this morning. One of the great things about running a business organization like the Bay Area Council is you have so many people at very high CEOs and folks who operate at very high levels in the business community who care so much about the effectiveness and what's happening in the community. And generally speaking, maybe in 8 out of 10 cases or more, the issue that really drives their passion is education. Talk to someone, say you should join the Bay Area Council. Answer often is, well, what are you folks doing about education? Comes up in the Constitutional Convention context as well. And so we've put a lot of effort on this historically and recently to make sure that education is at the forefront of our mission at the Council. We're very pleased to have Linda Gallagher. Linda, stand up and take a bow. She's our Vice President for Education. Does a fantastic job and is really linked in, I think, in all the key places in Sacramento and in Washington as we move this agenda forward and with the major foundations and many folks who are here. Amongst the leaders in education in the business community, I don't think there's anyone more talented, more knowledgeable, and more passionate about the subject than our own chairman, Lenny Mendonca, who's a global partner with McKinsey. And McKinsey is the source of the work that we're going to hear about this morning, about what the achievement gap really means to the economy and what we can do about it. And so it's been a real pleasure. Lenny's been chair of the council for a couple of years, but has been involved way back, and he's committed to stay on. We're not exactly going to let him go when his chairmanship runs out in a little while. We're going to keep him fully engaged. You can count on that. So I want to take a moment and introduce Lenny to come up to the podium and talk a little bit about what you're going to hear about today and introduce our first guest speaker. So Lenny Mendonca, the chairman of the Bay Area Council.
Thanks, Jim. And like Jim, I just got back from vacation, but it was a little bit less glamorous than the boat that Jim had that he got a nice suntan. I was actually in Michigan, and just a couple stories of what I saw in Michigan that can help set the context here, too, and quick anecdotes. One is that I opened the paper on the first day there, and there was an editorial calling for a constitutional convention in Michigan. And they were talking about learning from California what they needed to do. And the last time their constitution got rewritten was when Governor Romney, Mitt's dad, was governor of Michigan. And they said it might be time to rewrite it. So we're exporting some of our thinking here. But later in the week, I saw an editorial cartoon that had a picture of the map of Michigan. And it said, "Welcome to East California." And I think that's a little bit more indicative of what we're exporting more generally, is that we're increasingly get compared to Detroit rather than the future. And I'm reminded every day I look at the newspaper about what's happening in the budget battles of my friends from Alabama, who always say when they look at rankings, "Thank God for Mississippi." Well, I never thought that California would be in that route that we're being compared to Mississippi and Alabama on these measures, and it's just criminal from my standpoint. You know, each day the news for California students in particular worsens, whether it's in K-12 or in higher education. The legislature and the governor are not yet there, but they're acting to figure out how we cut billions of dollars from an already underinvested education system. And the impact that's going to have on our kids, their education, and the long-term consequences to California is going to be severe. Not only will our state lose its competitive advantage that we've had for a very long time of being at the leading edge of competing on global talent, but more importantly, a whole generation of children could lose their opportunities for a better and brighter future. In some remarks recently to the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, President Obama reminded us that we can't simply wait for a better today to address these issues. He said, and I quote, "I know there are some who believe that we can only handle one challenge at a time. They forget that Lincoln helped lay down the Transcontinental Railroad, passed the Homestead Act, and created the National Academy of Sciences in the midst of the Civil War." If there's an immediate call to action, I think it's this. The students in school today can't wait for the economic recovery, and we can't afford the economic realities and consequences of failing to educate every child. The education crisis is with us here today, and we need to do something about it. We've got to find a way to reform the system and provide the resources necessary to make it work. The federal stimulus package is part of the opportunity through billions of dollars of funding on a competitive basis that could help our students. But the political and power dynamics in California are lining up in a way that our state may not be eligible for those, which would just be tragic. California must compete for these funds, and we've got to work together to remove any or clarify any statutory or regulatory barriers that get in the way. We need real leadership from the governor, from the legislature, the superintendent of schools. Most of all, we need all of our education partners, those of us in the room, from our districts, our unions, our administrators, our foundations and think tanks, the business leaders, charter school leaders, nonprofits, parents, and elected leaders need to work together, or California could lose its opportunity to get its hundreds of millions of dollars out of the stimulus. And for the rest of us, it's our job to keep the pressure on, to do all we can to advocate for education, for closing the achievement gap, and for overcoming the political hurdles and obstacles to get there from there. Today, we're going to have a chance to talk about those and put them in the context of the current environment. And we'll talk about them in very concrete and economic-related terms. First, I'm delighted to introduce our first speaker, Matt Miller, who's going to present some research that was done at McKinsey that provides a compelling piece, illuminating why education must be our top priority and not just when times are good. He's going to talk about it, so I'm not going to give a big, long introduction to the content of the work, but let me just first introduce Matt a little more thoroughly. Matt, in his business life, is a senior advisor to McKinsey, and I have had the great pleasure of working with Matt for a large portion of his time that he's been with us. His bio was in the material, so I won't go through it in detail, but let me just say that Matt has provided enormous contributions to thought leadership, knowledge, and speaking and writing on a wide range of important topics facing the country, education being one of the most important one of those. He's a formidable intellect, a prolific and really high-impact writer that looks at problems and says not why can't this be solved, but looks at them and says this is a product of things like his new book, The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, that are functions of the past, not about what we need to do going forward. Matt is a creative and thoughtful person, and I'm sure you'll enjoy listening to him. So with that, let me introduce my friend Matt Miller.
Thank you, Lenny. And thanks to the Bay Area Council and everyone involved in bringing this group together this morning. I have to applaud the Bay Area Council's leadership, not just on education, but in trying to bring some clarity to the chaos that is California. I live in L.A., so from the southern half of the state, I experience the same frustration and angst over what's going on in our state. And what's amazing about what the Bay Area Council has done is it's already moved the Constitutional Convention from what I would have said, you know, a year or 15 months ago was a kind of fringe idea to something that the governor and leaders in both parties are saying is really must have if we're going to get some control over California's future. Now, I suppose that's also just an index of how deeply dysfunctional we've become, but it's really important work, and the Bay Area Council's been a leader in it. I'm also delighted to be in a room, because I could tell just from mingling over coffee that there's a lot of people very passionate about education, about the achievement gap, and understand what the stakes are and are working in various ways to try and make our kids' futures brighter. I also came across from Brian Kaplan at the Silicon Valley Education Foundation what I think may be the single best prop I've seen for education reform. It's an eraser with the Silicon Valley Foundation that says erase the achievement gap. So I'm surprised no one had thought of that before, but I wanted to give a plug to you, Brian, wherever you are, for an inventive way of communicating your mission, which is one that we all share. Everyone in this room knows what an enormous challenge the achievement gap is for the country, and many of you in your various forums have spoken and written and advocated eloquently about the moral costs of the achievement gap. Now, no one needed McKinsey to weigh in on the moral stakes of the achievement gap because that's all too clear. But it did seem to a number of us at McKinsey that there was a gap in the debate that no one had tried to address, which is to really quantify the impact on the national economy of the of this achievement gap. And so our work that I'm going to share with you some of the highlights of this morning focuses on the economic consequences, the economic costs of the achievement gap. There's a lot more detail in the reports that you should be able to take and read at your leisure, and I hope you will because we can't cover it all in a brief presentation. But overall, there are really three big findings from this research. The first finding is what we think of as the complexity of the gap, because there's really four gaps. There are profound and troubling gaps along race and income lines, as we know, but the gap between the United States and other rich countries is very large, as are the achievement gaps among and within our many education systems inside the U.S. The achievement gap, this means, doesn't just affect poor children in failing schools, it affects most children in most schools. That's message one. Second, the economic costs of these gaps are enormous, imposing on the U.S. economy the equivalent of a permanent and deep national recession. That recession, as we'll discuss, is bigger in its macroeconomic impact than our immediate credit-driven recession that we're going through, this being the recession that everyone, by kind of acclamation, says is the deepest downturn since the Great Depression. Third, there are powerful reasons for hope. We believe, and the research shows, that demographics need not be destiny. Systems do matter. We can learn from what the most successful educators and school systems are doing in our own country to close these achievement gaps, and we can also learn from other countries. So let's start, as we trot through this, with our international achievement gap. Relative to our wealthy country peers, our children start off in the middle of the pack, but by the time they reach high school, they fall into near the back of the pack. For example, on the OECD's PISA exam for mathematics, our 15-year-olds are now ranked 25th out of 30 countries. Moreover, few students from the U.S. perform at the very highest international levels. Countries like Korea, Switzerland, and Belgium have at least five times the number of students scoring at the highest levels of proficiency. Now, we don't just have an excellence gap internationally. We have what we might think of as an equity gap as well. Now, this chart looks a little complicated, but let me take a minute to walk you through it because it's actually it's stunning in its implications, I think, for the U.S. Specifically, the gap between students from high and low-income families is much more pronounced in the United States than in other OECD nations. So this graph, which is from OECD data, looks at those results on the PISA math exams by socioeconomic status. The U.S. is right there in the middle where the two lines cross. So what that means is that all the countries higher than us on the graph have 15-year-olds who are performing better overall in terms of academic results, as you can see going up the left-hand axis. And all the countries to the left of us on the graph got more equal outcomes across different socioeconomic groups than did the United States. So the top left-hand corner is the quadrant to focus on, and there's 17 countries out of 30 that did both, had better academic results and also had more equal results when you think of socioeconomic background not determining what the outcomes are. Now think about that. The United States, which is a country that had a decades-long head start on universal secondary education, and a country to which generations of immigrants have crossed oceans to seek opportunity for their kids, 17 nations now have both higher and more equitable results in education, which is arguably the most fundamental measure of opportunity. We think this should be very troubling for all of us. Now, let's break down this troubling fact a little more by looking at the achievement gap by race and ethnicity. No matter which achievement or attainment measure is used, whether it's standardized tests, high school graduation, college graduation, Black and Latino students perform significantly lower than their white counterparts. Take, for example, performance on the National Assessment of Educational Progress fourth grade math test. 3 to 4 times the share of Black and Latino students perform below basic as for white students. This is very bad news, but it's also relatively well known. Less well known on the right-hand side of the scale here is that only 1% of black and Latino students are performing at advanced levels. That's only 1/8 the share of white students that reach that level. And these are the students that are being prepared to be engineers and entrepreneurs to have the high-wage jobs of the future. These gaps occur throughout the country, across subjects and grade levels, even in the highest performing states. So Massachusetts, for example, which has the highest scores in the country on math, still sees 8 times as many black and Latino students perform below basic as white students. One of the interesting findings, which is detailed more in the report from our research, is that even states with the highest scores, like Massachusetts or Minnesota, just because you're high scoring overall doesn't mean you don't have striking achievement gaps that are in many cases bigger than those in other states. And like the international gap, this racial gap gets worse as our students get older. So between grades 4 and 12, the achievement gap between white and Latino students grows by 41%, and the gap between white and black students grows by 22%. Unfortunately, the picture is not much better when we look at the achievement gap by income. This next chart shows the NAEP test for grade 8. Now, using eligibility for free and reduced lunch as a proxy for low income, we see similar disparities. 6 times as many low-income students perform below basic on grade 4 math and 4 times as many in reading. In points, average scores for low-income students are 26 points behind in math and 24 points behind in reading. That's about 2.5 years behind in school if you use these measures as a rough proxy for years of learning. Now, one question you might ask is whether, since so many black and Latino youth live in conditions of poverty, whether the racial and income gaps are in fact the same phenomena, and our answer from the research was no. Both the racial and income gaps coexist and compound each other, is what we found. Back to fourth grade math. There's an income achievement gap of about 1.5 years of school, both for white students and for black students. And there's a racial achievement gap between whites and black students in similar income strata. It all adds up to a huge gap in achievement between white students from families of means and black students living in poverty, around 3.5 years of progress. Again, these results are deeply troubling, but perhaps not surprising. But it turns out there's another achievement gap about as large as the racial and income gaps put together. Perhaps the most surprising result from our research is the enormous variation of outcomes across education systems, what we call the system-based achievement gap. If you follow the healthcare debate, there's a kind of similar aspect to what we know in healthcare today, which is, as they debate the health reform in Washington, it's become a real focus that there's a huge variation in the intensity and utilization and quality performance of various regions of the country that are largely unrelated to what inputs or spending gets done. And we're finding the same variations occur in school districts across the country. The lesson from that for us is that systems matter. The policies and practices of systems, of districts, and of schools matter profoundly. Students from the same racial and socioeconomic backgrounds who are in different states have significantly different performance. New Jersey and Connecticut, for example. New Jersey has better NAEP results and a smaller racial achievement gap despite having a lower income per capita and a higher proportion of racial and ethnic minorities than Connecticut, about 0.5 year's difference in learning. Or Texas and California is another example, 2 states with very similar demographics. On average, California students, black, white, and Latino, are 1 to 2 years of learning behind comparable students in Texas. So systems matter. Within states, we found similar students in different districts also perform differently. For example, and there's details on this in the report, we looked at 4 urban Texas districts with similar poverty levels and minority populations, and 1/4 more students are proficient in math in the best performing of those districts than in the other 3. So school systems matter. What happens in these systems matters. Even within districts, similar students at different schools perform very differently. We looked at 2 high-poverty, majority-black middle schools in the same Texas school districts. Students at 1 performed 20 to 30 percentage points higher on state tests. So schools matter. And we know, of course, from the evidence in the U.S. and internationally, that teachers and teaching matter profoundly. Maybe they matter most. There's a huge variation between classes within the same schools, so teaching and the quality of practice in every school matters. There are more detailed examples in the report, But let's turn now to the economic price we pay as a nation as a result of these four achievement gaps. From the national economic standpoint, what does all this translate to? What does it mean? Where do these gaps leave us? We think the answer is stunning. These gaps are imposing the equivalent of a permanent recession on the U.S. economy. This means it is not just an issue for minorities or for the poor, it's an issue for us all. Now, on the one hand, the magnitudes that I'll show you in a second may seem surprising, but in another sense, it only stands to reason that the price of leaving this much human potential underdeveloped is going to be huge in the United States. So let's look at the details. What this chart tries to show in terms of the numbers is what our GDP would have been last year if we'd been able to raise our performance to various benchmarks. And these numbers are shown as a range because there are lots of complications in doing this economic analysis, and we didn't want to create something with a kind of false sense of precision. But these ranges and the orders of magnitudes that they illustrate, we think, are very compelling and important to understand. So on the left-hand stack of dollars, if we had raised our performance to the level of top-performing Finland or Korea, the best-performing systems in the world today, the gain in U.S. GDP last year would have been between $1.3 and $2.3 trillion. Moving across, if we'd improved Black and Latino student scores to the level of white students, the gain in GDP would have been $310 to $525 billion. Next, if we had lifted the scores of students with family incomes of less than $25,000 to the same level of students with families earning more than $25,000, the GDP gain would have been $400 to $670 billion. And then finally, if we had increased the scores of all students performing in states with averages below the national average, just to the average, so we're not trying to bring everybody to the level of Massachusetts, for example, but if we had brought the bottom up to the average, the GDP impact would have been $425 to $710 billion numbers. Now, just by comparison, if you look at the GDP impact of recent recessions, you'd see that the one in the early 70s saw a dip of about 3% below our economic potential. In the early 80s, it was around 3%. And in the fourth quarter of 08, which was the data we had when this went to press, and it's roughly borne out by what we're seeing now, you had something on the order of magnitude of around a 6% drop in economic output. Now, by comparison, the racial gap is between 2-ish and 3.5% of GDP. The income gap is between almost 3 and 4.6. The system-based gap we just discussed is between around 3 and 5% of GDP. And then there's the international gap. Again, that's the gap between performance of the U.S. as a whole and performance of the countries with the leading performing educational systems in the world today. And it's a stunning 9 to 16% of GDP in terms of what the absolute impact is of what this is doing. So this is larger. The point we're trying to demonstrate is this is larger than the worst recent recessions in memory and arguably require a response that's equal to the magnitude of what the stakes are. Now, the achievement gap doesn't just have these macroeconomic effects, obviously, but also profound effects on individuals. You know, achievement in school matters enormously to an individual's life chances. So take, for example, here two students that performed in the bottom quartile on fourth grade math. Now suppose one remained in the bottom quartile on eighth grade math assessments and the other improved to the top quartile because of better schools, better teaching, better interventions, and so forth. By the time those students are in the job market, the one who moved up will have a 40% higher median income. Now, only 10% of students performing in the bottom quartile on eighth grade math receive a bachelor's degree. Assuming that our poor performing student graduated from high school but did not pursue higher education, in addition to lower median income, that individual will have lower lifetime earnings, because a college graduate makes about 73% more of their lifetime, a higher probability of incarceration. It's even worse for a high school dropout. College-educated black men are 5 times less likely to be in jail than high school dropouts. And they'll have a less healthy lifestyle, a higher probability of smoking and obesity. They're more likely to be uninsured. There's also less civic engagement, something that often doesn't get discussed in the education context, but there's just simply lower participation and less civic engagement in our common public life for those who don't get educated as well. And that's a price we all pay. This situation isn't all that unrealistic. In New York City, 87% of students scoring in the bottom quartile on fourth grade math remained in the bottom half in eighth grade, and only 2% moved to the top quartile, like the student in this example. So schools and systems matter. While fourth grade scores are important indicators, that doesn't mean they are destiny. Graduation outcomes in New York have been linked to how much a student progressed or regressed between third and eighth grade. When students who scored the same in third grade, over 10% dropped out, while only 2 to 4% of students whose scores improved dropped out. So the actions we take collectively through our schools obviously matter enormously. Now, lest this data seem depressing, we think there's an important case for optimism, and here's where it starts. States matter. Among students of similar race and income levels, there's significant variation. If the same student lived in a different state, they would be doing better. Low-income black students, as you can see here in Texas, are roughly 2 years ahead of learning of low-income black students in Washington, D.C. Low-income white students in Massachusetts are roughly a year and a half ahead in learning of low-income white students in Alabama. But low-income white students in Alabama are at the same level of low-income black students in Texas. So the point of this data, and there's more in the report, is that there are not predetermined paths. We think the research makes clear that race and poverty are not destiny. More recently, the outcome of work done in New Jersey to close the achievement gap is getting attention that's worth taking note of. This came after a whole history of various school finance equity lawsuits and different resources being devoted, especially to early education and literacy in the early years. And as a consequence, over a 15-year period in New Jersey, the gap between average scores of white students and black students decreased by 16 points over 1.5 years of learning. In 2005, New Jersey was the only state in which scores in all ethnic categories improved. In 2007, fourth graders in New Jersey scored above all other states except Massachusetts. In particular, there's been remarkable success in closing the gap in at least one high-poverty district in New Jersey, Union City, virtually eliminating the achievement gap between white and minority students as a result of an intense focus on early literacy, and we think there's learning to be had from some of these practices that could be applied across the country. It's not just there. There are examples elsewhere. Latino students in Ohio, for example, score the same as their white peers in 8 states and better than their white peers in 13 states. In New York City, the country's largest district, achievement scores of low-income black fourth graders improved by 8 points in 4 years. That's almost one full year of learning. There's more examples like this in the report. Now, to close for now, where does all this leave us? I know there are a lot of ideas in this room and beyond about how to close these gaps, and there's a growing body of evidence on what works in education in the U.S. and around the world. Our research wasn't about detailed solution, but I do want to underscore several thoughts. The first is we need to tackle this with urgency. In a time of economic pain, the achievement gap is costing the United States $3 to $5 billion each day in lost economic output. The moral cost, of course, may be even higher. Second point is that this is about all of us. It is true, there's no question, that the costs of the gap today fall most heavily on black, Latino, and low-income youth. But the magnitude of the international and systems gaps show that much of the broad American middle class will pay dearly for our complacency today. Many white middle-class children are being prepared for $10 an hour jobs and will see their dreams deferred as well. The third point is that school systems matter. It is undeniable that there are many factors outside school that affect our children's life chances. No reasonable person can deny that, and there are raging debates about which matters most. But our research convinces us that once kids show up at the schoolhouse door, no matter where they come from, we see fundamentally different trajectories depending on what happens inside schools. So what we do in our schools matters profoundly. A fourth point is that better data is essential. This is obviously something that would come from a research group, but this research was much more difficult than it should have been, because once you get into this, the most detailed data from state tests are far too inconsistent to compare with each other. We've got this crazy quilt system where everybody sort of looks at things differently. It makes it very difficult to do the kind of common sense benchmarking that any business can do or any other organization. And, you know, when we're spending over $600 billion a year on public education, we've got very little and very poor data on the whole to guide our investments. And then finally, there's a strong case for optimism. Education systems can make enormous progress when a country aligns behind making it happen. We know this because a couple of dozen other countries have done just that over the past 20 or 30 years. That's why we're slipping in these rankings. We also know we have a lot of success to build on taking place in various places in our own country. Now, none of us here knows all the answers, and we're convinced that solving this problem is going to require all of us to move beyond our comfort zones. I think the question now is how quickly we act to identify and replicate what works. This is a struggle with huge consequences, again, not only for poor Black and Latino children, whose parents know their schools are failing, but for middle-class white students whose parents wrongly think their kids are doing just fine. We hope a heightened sense of the colossal economic price the nation pays for not fully developing its youth can help us move beyond educational finger-pointing and inspire common ground on urgent reforms. After all, when you consider the unprecedented emergency measures we're mounting to combat today's official recession, doesn't the vastly larger education recession deserve a crusade of its own? Thank you. Questions? Thoughts? Yes. Sir. We didn't look in particular in this research at the specific aspects of those systems. We were trying to just do a good benchmarking of what the output gap would be. But other research that my McKinsey colleagues have done on what makes what the attributes are of world-class systems like Singapore, Finland, South Korea, and what's clear in all of them is that the and they state it as a kind of axiom that seems obvious but is something that we in the U.S. at least don't take seriously, which is that the quality of the school system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. And in those world-class systems around the world, they typically recruit from the top third of the college class for their teaching corps. We in the U.S., especially in high-poverty districts, recruit from the bottom third of the college class. There's an enormous emphasis placed on training up and professional development. It's considered an elite kind of designation. To get into the teacher preparation institutions in Finland or Singapore, for example, is highly selective. Maybe 1 in 8 or 1 in 10 young people get accepted. If you've followed at all what goes on with education schools in the U.S., you know, if you can somehow pay the freight, you get in. And so the prestige, in some cases the compensation, especially the starting compensation, and the entire culture around the teaching profession in these best-performing systems around the world, it makes a key difference. It's clear. Yes, sir. Well, it's an interesting paradox because one of the things you'll see in the report that I didn't talk about in the presentation is that we are spending either above or at the level of a lot of our wealthy nation peers. And so our view is that we're in the middle of the bottom of the pack in lots of the international measures. So our view would be that in aggregate, our system is probably inefficient in terms of the outcomes we're getting for the investment we're putting in, and so that there ought to be ways to rejigger the way we're using resources to improve outcomes. I think we also note, though, that there are huge inequities between wealthier districts and poorer districts in the U.S. as an observation, inequalities that are not seen in other world-class systems or really in any other advanced industrial democracy. So I don't think we'd say that money doesn't matter, but that money spent smartly is the key to successful reform. Ma'am?
I'm curious, you have presented, you say systems do schools
You're right. And this report doesn't address that. I don't know if we have current plans to do that in a kind of report. You know, we do a lot of work with school districts both here and around the world where benchmarking and analyzing that, and I understand the debates that you're talking about, the deep versus wide. It's something that perhaps should be on our agenda, but we haven't done thoughtful work on it right now. A gentleman back there. Well, we think that I hope you haven't seen the GDP numbers before, because we felt that's one of the contributions we were making. I think by action, McKinsey's not a political organization, but for all the stakeholders in this debate, what we hoped is that by introducing the economic lens to this, which we think has sometimes been missing in the discussion, it can help galvanize the energy from all stakeholders in the debate to have a sense of urgency on this that we think the stakes deserve. We'll certainly be working to disseminate the findings of this research and to help all interested groups get the magnitude of this into what their understanding of the problem. In my personal capacity outside McKinsey, I'll be working very hard to try and do this, but everyone in their personal life would do things like that slightly differently. So this gentleman. If I take off my McKinsey hat for a minute, there's actually one of the dead ideas in what Lenny Mendoza called the tyranny of dead ideas in the book I have out, which somebody is touting right here. I actually think one of the dead ideas that we're in the grip of is that schools are a local matter. Now, this applies differently in California than in the rest of the country, but by and large, in the U.S., local funding of schools is and the local setting of standards for what kids should learn in a 21st century global economy is done in a way that's very different than basically all the other advanced nations with whom we compete. And the extent of the local funding, the property tax and related state taxes that plays an outsized portion in our school funding system is really why we have these dramatic inequities, in particular between the typical high-poverty district and the nearby affluent suburbs, which, as you know, can range from $5,000 per student to $10,000 per student. I heard Arne Duncan talking about Chicago the other day, where he came from, where you drive up the road from the district that he ran, and there's 2.5 times more of the per pupil spending, and it's only, you know, a 15-minute drive up the road, and that obviously makes a difference in attracting and retaining teachers and the kind of facilities and programs and books and materials that one's exposed to. So my own personal view is that that's an important issue, if we don't get beyond that, I think we'll have a hard time lifting the bottom in ways that we need to. Ted? The thing I'm most familiar with is a lot of the early childhood advocacy groups who talk about investment in preschool and stuff typically show a multiple, you know, if you every dollar invested in preschool or Head Start, you get some very substantial return. I'm not as familiar with that being done on some of the other stuff. But again, I would say, I think our point of view from this research at McKinsey is you have to remember at the macro level, our education system is inefficient compared to other wealthy nations. So it's not just a matter of more money, even though money well spent effectively in systems that are well designed matters enormously. But it is important to recall, just like with healthcare, two of our biggest sectors in the economy on aggregate are inefficient, meaning we put more in than other wealthy nations and we get less out.
state system is about 4.4. But the question that I wanted to ask you was, did your study look at any correlation between our achievement gap and the offshoring of our jobs and the labor arbitrage? I know it's part of the economic impact, but that's a specific aspect, especially as it looks for higher education.
We didn't look at that in particular in this study, although obviously the quality of our workforce, as reflected in what we're seeing, is going to affect any decision by employers who can cite jobs now around the world as to the cost-benefit equation and the talent pool that we have here. So I think that's an enormous challenge for the country in the context. We've done other recent research that talks about the need. If you look at the trends in the labor market over the last 10 or 15 years, the forces, including globalization, that are at work have an enormous impact on the wage growth or the depression of wages for a lot of job categories in the U.S. And we think the ultimate answer to that has to be a dramatic upgrading of the skill level of the U.S. workforce with a level of urgency that we think is not on the radar screen today. Sir?
My name is Peter Costello. I'm a concerned citizen. I have a question about, I've been interested in service learning for about 20 years now, and that came from my interest in programs like AmeriCorps or VISTA, Peace Corps, and the concept of the National Service System. My question is, how familiar are you with service learning, and how does that relate to this in having mentors help these people close their gaps by having highly educated students working with lower educated students? And the second question is, like in your book, you talk about being stuck in the mud. What catalyst do you see is feasible today, this year, that could break this up?
Well, on the latter point, I think it's always going to be the mobilization of lots of concerned citizens like yourself that is what drives change. And if we wait for change to go, we need extraordinary leadership, obviously, but we also need what I think of as extraordinary followership and citizenship if we're going to mobilize in a way that makes change. I'm not an expert on the service learning stuff. I will tell you that I'm aware of some charter schools that are trying to use the mentoring. One of the problems, especially in California, where you've got this very low per pupil spending and the charter schools end up getting even less, some of them are trying some innovative ways to use older students who are great students in math or science to help mentor the younger kids, because you can't always afford to get more teachers in or more highly paid teachers. And so in some sense, necessity ends up being the mother of invention in ways that I think are good for the mentor and also good for the mentee and maybe worth looking at more broadly. It sounds terrific, and we'd love to learn more about some of the details of this. Great. Yes, ma'am.
Some of the opportunities for the kids who come with more disadvantage.
Well, though we didn't go in depth into this, we did note that there's a, at the end of the report, that the U.S. does have these inequities between districts that are kind of unique to the U.S. Other countries don't permit those kind of vast inequities. In terms of just the performance of the other schools, though, it was that one chart where I pointed out the top left-hand quadrant. We've got so many countries now. You know, we're supposed to be the land of opportunity that are clearly doing a better job having higher levels of student achievement with less of the a kid's fate being dependent on the income or socioeconomic background of the family they come from. And that, I think, should be striking to us because it's really suggesting that we're not a leader by our own standards and our own American creed. And so part of it may be money, but part of it is also the quality of the teaching core, the prestige, and the there may be a whole host of factors. And again, this study was more about trying to benchmark the dimensions of the economic cost than to offer detailed solutions. But I think that the facts of our lagging performance by our own standards in every way are plain. Did you come out just for this?
I love the title of your book.
I liked you the moment I laid eyes on you.
And obviously, I would ask, what other dead ideas are we hanging, you know, as a noose around our neck? It seems to me your title, The Achievement Gap, when I walked in here, I said, oh, no, not another talk about the same data. But it wasn't. It was also about the other achievement gap.
We couldn't agree more. I mean, the thing that struck us most about the research, and I'm glad that some of this did seem fresh because our point was to try and bring the economic lens in a different way. And
the gaps, and I think a lot of us have heard enough about that other gap. And, you know, I don't know, you're sort of thinking of titles. I would think you know what I mean? It's two different gaps.
Yes, and I guess the magnitude of the international gap is so huge that we think that you know, the more people become aware of that, the more we think it'll create a broader sense of urgency and perhaps a constituency for change, because if average middle class or upper middle class families are complacent about what's happening in their public schools, which many are, they don't realize what the trajectory is for their own kids versus what's happening in other countries. I think we just got a minute or two left in this segment. Yes, ma'am. What is QEIA?
Quality Education. Somebody else might know the numbers for the name. And so the key seems to me, the teachers that went back to school and did the training that came with that money. So we've got another problem, because at some point the teachers that come from schools of education need to be ready to know how to do what those veteran teachers needed to learn. And I don't know how soon
Great points. Last question, sir. It's not work that we've done, although I believe there's a lot of work that's been done by some of the different think tanks and research institutes. So if you looked at either Brookings or the Center for American Progress or New America Foundation or others, you may find, I think you'd find a fair amount of work on that. Thank you very much for your attention, and turn it over to you.
Thank you, Matt, very much. That was it's incredible work. I want to thank you and McKinsey for that. And it's just amazing to see those figures. I think the purpose of this is to indicate the potential that we have if we can address education and what that would mean to the economy. And it's actually quite startling. I didn't realize it was of that magnitude, even though I think we're all aware it's of a huge magnitude. I realized New Jersey had better roads. I suspected they had better schools, and we've been monitoring their work on early childhood education, and clearly it's that and other efforts that they're making there, obviously a major investment, is having an effect in New Jersey. In New York, one of the things I observed is when you watch television a little bit, Mayor Bloomberg is constantly on TV with commercials he probably funded himself about education and what he's done. And so the idea of fixing New York's education system is front and center in people's minds, care of Mayor Bloomberg. And I think that's an indication of maybe the potential leadership. You know, the question came up a number of times. Well, what can we do about it? We know we have programs that are working, that are models that could be broadened and instituted throughout the district. There's been a lot of great work. There's a lot of great work that's going on. That's what the council is really all about. What we're trying to figure out is how we can provide leadership. Clearly, from my experience, especially when you get up in places like Sacramento, but it's not just in Sacramento, there is a systemic resistance. So when people talk about the situation, they often immediately go to thinking about how the system works and how we can make things work within the context of the system that we all understand. And, as I've watched what's happened here in the state, you know, I'm not really too into that discussion. So, and the Constitutional Convention, the leadership that we've provided should be an indication to you who want to see real change that we're not really so concerned about reforming things within the context of the system. And so when folks say, well, if you did that, it would do this to the system, and that necessarily would be a bad thing because it would indicate some kind of change that would impact people within the system in some way, you know, my view of that is, okay, well, in this situation that we're in, with this kind of an achievement gap and this kind of an economic impact on all these levels, maybe it's time for that. And we think the citizens in general would agree with that. We think most of the people participating and frustrated by the existing systems would want to go for that. And maybe this is the time that we can do it. The Hewlett Foundation provided us a grant of $700,000 over a couple of years. Recently, in order to provide leadership within the business community. We can't fix this situation, but we can participate and we can help lead on this, and business should certainly count on it. And so what we need to understand is how to provide that leadership. We're clearly, you should see the Constitutional Convention as a clear indication of our willingness to, blow it up and start over if that's what's required. And in many cases, in some cases we need to do that. In other cases, maybe more refinement. But we're very excited, and this the work that you've done, Matt, is very helpful in I think from a business perspective, aiding us in expressing to our members and others in the business community, as well as those who are public policy makers, as to exactly what it is that we're trying to achieve with this and why it's absolutely critical. And it's like a war. I mean, we're fighting, everybody thinks of a war in terms of soldiers on the battlefield and sending drones into Afghanistan and stuff like that. you know, that's not, you know, this is the war that we actually should be fighting. And I think if people were more aware of how these other nations are basically cleaning our clock out there, I do think it's going to make a big difference. And so our primary focus here is the work in California. You know, we understand the situation of what's happening with our own state systems. That's the data that we're most familiar with. This is the place where we live. It's a very big state. It's a very complex place, but it is the primary area of our focus. And we're very pleased to have with us today one of the top experts, if not maybe the top in the country, Linda Darling-Hammond, to give us her views on how the national policies and the effects of the economic stimulus can be directed to address the potential changes we need to make in the California system, as well as nationally. Linda, of course, is a professor of education. We all know her well and the passion she has for the teaching system and the school systems here in our state. But she, you know, as well, you know that she was the leader of President Barack Obama's transition team on education. So she's got a tremendous insight on what's happening in Washington and the programs within the stimulus and probably what we'll see in the future coming out of the education in D.C. and how we can apply that and get in front of it here in California. Clearly what we need to do is we need to see the future. We need to be able to see what it looks like, how the national program shapes up, get ahead of that so that we can provide a pathway to be able to receive at least our fair share, if not more, of the support that we're going to need to make this major shift ahead. So it's a great honor and pleasure for us to have Linda Darling-Hammond with us today. So enlighten us, please.
Magic. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to follow Matt. I always find his ideas interesting and invigorating, and in this case, very similar to my own. So I'm going to rush through some of the slides I have, which will look familiar to you, because we actually have a very similar take on this issue, and get to the question of what ought we to do here in California, and how can we, in parts of that, take advantage of some of the investments from the federal government in the stimulus package. Some of you may have seen the video that John Merrow did called From First to Worst, which was his account of the slide of California schools after Proposition 13. So I've entitled this, How Do We Move From Worst to First? And, you know, Matt outlined a four-part achievement gap. Somebody else talked about a double achievement gap. I talked about a triple threat, a three-part achievement gap, and you've already seen the aspects of this within California, between California and the rest of the country and our country and the rest of the world. And these are just some of the most recent data from NAEP about the percentage of students proficient in reading, math, writing, and science. And you can see that in each context, Latino and African American students are meeting those targets of proficiency at much lower levels than white and Asian students in California. Also, of course, relative to Matt's point, California students aren't hitting those proficiency targets in any case at the level of many students in other states. Right now, California is ranking on the National Assessment of Educational Progress between 45th and 49th. In reading, math, and science at fourth and eighth grade level. Science is the area where we say most fervently, thank God for Mississippi, because it is the only state that falls below us in science right now, which, of course, is very ironic given the high-tech future and present that California has. And that's going to get us, I'm going to come back around to the issues of curriculum on this, which someone from Palo Alto raised earlier, because there are serious issues around the nature of the curriculum and the assessment system that differentiate us from other countries. I have been finishing a book on what are the practices in high-achieving nations around the world in respect to teaching, curriculum, assessment, funding, et cetera. It's called The Flat World in Education, and it'll be out in about a month or two. And I'll say a little about some of the questions that you asked earlier that I think give us some idea about what kind of directions we need to consider as we move forward. You know all of this about the rankings in terms of the spending rates in California, that we are 48th in spending. So there is a big difference between us and New Jersey in overall spending, as well as the inequality of spending, because New Jersey has finally been forced to equalize spending to a substantial extent after 30 years of fighting it. We have a reputation for being an equalized state. It is not an earned reputation any longer. The lowest spending districts are in California are spending around $6,000, the highest spending over $20,000. It's more than a 3-to-1 ratio across the state. So, and, you know, many people here are very familiar with the Williams lawsuit and other efforts to raise to attention the many, many schools which lack libraries, art and music programs, you know, safe facilities, et cetera. So we do look in many of our schools like a third world country. The red bars are districts in California that serve almost exclusively students of color. The blue bars are districts that serve predominantly white students, and the distribution of expenditures, you know, follows that. Matt has already talked about where we rank internationally in comparison to other countries. I just want to point out that if you look at Finland at the top in science and math, Korea near the top in math and in the top 10 in science, also doing well in reading, these are countries that in 1970 were nowhere in terms of education. They had poor, low-achieving, inequitable education systems. So, and we were number one in the world, unquestionably, in education in the 1970s. So this is partly a question of what have people been doing for the last 40 years? And, you know, what we've been staying sort of in place while other nations have been making the kinds of efficient, sensible investments that move them ahead. This, again, just demonstrates how much inequality drives our rankings. And that the issues are also in attainment. We were first in the world in basic high school attainment in the 70s. We were 13th as of a few years ago when this chart was created. Korea was 27th in terms of high school in the 70s. It's now first in terms of graduation rates. And we're moving in the opposite direction of the rest of the world. So we are now going downhill in graduation and college-going rates, while others are rapidly going uphill. There's a myth that says that, oh, well, the U.S. educates more of its kids in high school. That was true in the 1980s. It has not been true for the last 10 years. So high-achieving countries are graduating 90, 95, 98, 99% of their kids from high school. And in countries like Korea, they're sending 80% of those kids, having graduated 95 or more percent, they're sending 80-plus percent of those kids to college. We're graduating about 67% of our students, and much lower rates for African-American and Latino students. And in California, we're only getting about 28% of our kids through college. So we're really falling behind in what's necessary. In the economy, dropouts are increasing, and the number of college freshmen is decreasing. Just to give you that in international perspective, looking at Korean students on the far left, California students and California Latino and African-American students, the percentage graduating from high school and completing college is almost not comparable any longer. So I don't mean to just add to the depression that Matt already began to put us into, but I think it's important to understand sort of the big context here. So what are these high-achieving nations doing? First of all, we do have the highest poverty rate for children of the industrialized nations. So 22% of our kids are in poverty. But more than that, our safety net for children and families is more tattered. So even other countries that have poverty rates provide housing, health care, provide preschool and early learning child care contexts routinely and universally so that kids come to school ready to learn that day. When I was in Singapore recently, where 80% of families live in public housing. The public housing looks a lot like the co-op city in the Bronx. Big high rises, concrete, tiny little rooms, spare, clean, but not fancy by any stretch. But they come to school. First of all, everybody has health care. Everybody has some source of housing and income. And they come to schools which are outfitted to educate every kid well. So there's a laptop in every desk. There's a very well-qualified teacher in every classroom. Not only do they recruit them from the top of the college class, which, by the way, is also true in many states. Massachusetts and Connecticut have long recruited teachers from the top third of their college class. But they also educate all of them well. They will go to school for 4 years to train to become a teacher, in most cases, and earn a salary while they train. And when they come out, they will be earning more than a beginning doctor when they enter the classroom. They will, I'll take, we can recognize that. And then they will get mentoring from a very systematic set of programs to be sure that they learn to teach well under the guidance of expert veterans. And they will have, like other candidates in Asian and high-achieving European countries, they will have 15 to 25 hours a week to plan with other teachers to develop the curriculum, which, although they have national standards, they develop the curriculum locally in the schools to work on the assessments, to visit each other's classrooms, to engage in lesson study, to do action research, which every teacher in Singapore is now engaged in doing. And as they progress in the career, they have three career ladder options to become a curriculum specialist, a mentor, or a principal, again, completely at state expense, with training programs in place to build the profession so that all along the way you have qualified expert professionals in every aspect of the system. So that's one example. You could look at Finland, very similar story in Finland. Massive investments in initial teacher education are the story in Finland. These kinds of investments in ongoing teacher learning. Equitable funding, as Matt mentioned, and equitable salaries, because here one of the problems we have is that while we have some very well-prepared teachers and well-compensated teachers, it's so inequitable from district to district. I have two brand-new teachers living in my house, my daughters, neither of whom can afford an apartment in San Francisco on a beginning teacher's salary. And when they went looking for jobs, they could earn $10,000 less in San Francisco or Oakland than they could earn in Los Altos or Palo Alto. And you see that kind of thing all over the place. And that then drives the inequality that we see playing out elsewhere. The lean curriculum that, who was it who mentioned that in the back? Thank you. Is really high-achieving countries teach half as many topics a year in math and science. They teach them deeply. They'll spend, for example, a full year. I just went looked again at the Japanese math curriculum. Four big concepts in a year, not 33 chapters, you know, where you do a topic a week. You go deeply into it, learn it deeply, lots and lots of application, lots and lots of flexible thinking. Then you can build on it. They end up learning a lot more math because they learn it deeply along the way. They use performance assessments. Multiple choice testing is not a prominent mode of assessment in high-achieving nations. They use essay examinations. They use performance tasks, both at the end of the year and during the school year. And then they're making very, very large investments in higher education. The other point that I think is important is that they've actually made the curriculum less differentiated and tracked. In the highest achieving countries, Finland, Korea, Singapore, there's been a process over recent years of getting more and more kids access to higher and higher, more common levels of curriculum. And the countries that have maintained the very severe tracking systems that we often think about when we think about countries abroad are not doing well internationally. France, Germany, some of those countries are not at the top of the heap, and they've maintained that kind of system. So part of the question of how do you teach the highest achieving kids is to push the whole curriculum upwards rather than to differentiate too severely. This achievement gap will drive a growing state budget gap, and you know the data from PPIC that Californians will be less well-educated in the future than they are today. A huge part of our human resources are in our school-to-prison pipeline. So there are 400 times more people, 400% more people in prison in California than there were two decades ago. That really is sucking up much of the budget for education. So the $46,000 we spend on each inmate when we wouldn't spend $10,000 on those same kids when they were growing up in Oakland and Compton, Pasadena, to be sure that they had highly qualified teachers, adequate materials, supplies, and textbooks, and so on, is part of the ongoing problem that we have now. And now we're spending as much on corrections as on public higher education, reducing seats in colleges even while our needs for an educated workforce are growing. So these sources of inequality we've already talked about, and segregation makes it worse. We are the fifth most segregated state for black students, the third most segregated state for Latino students. About 40% of black and Latino students essentially attend apartheid schools. They are more than 90% African American and Latino, and they have seriously fewer resources in those schools. That means that their access to courses is limited. So one of the issues we have to attend to as we figure out what to do is how to get access to the kind of coursework kids need. The odds that in these highly segregated black and Latino schools you'll have access to an advanced math course at 10th, 11th, or 12th grade is only 1 in 3. It's only 1 in 2 in the less segregated schools, which is also not enough. So you have both inadequacy and equity. And the odds that those courses will be taught by teachers who are not trained in that content area and credentialed in that content area are also much higher. There's a 10-to-1 differential in the distribution of uncertified teachers to kids in high minority schools. And as a PPIC report recently outlined, among school resource measures, the level of teacher experience and the percentage without a full credential are most strongly related to student achievements. So those are obviously issues that Matt has already flagged for us, but they are key to what California could do efficiently with funding from the stimulus. And I'm going to talk about what the sources of those funds are, but it's also important to have a strategy. I want to just say one other word about this efficiency differential because it came up earlier. We do spend about as much as other countries and more than many per pupil on our schools. We spend much less of it on teachers. About 80% of education employees in Japan are classroom teachers, 70 to 80% in all of those countries I named earlier. In this country, it's 43%. Of education employees are classroom teachers. We have a lot of people who are around the system. They are supporting, managing, controlling, or in otherwise supplementing the work of teachers, but they are not classroom teachers themselves. That allows them, that money that they spend on teachers and on being sure that they're equitable and competitive salaries and time for teachers to be good at what they do is what drives a lot of the efficiency in their system. Because we don't make that investment, because we allow tremendous inequality, and we have some very good teachers, we have some strong preparation programs, and we have some very weak ones, and we haven't undertaken policies to drive the weak training towards strong training or to equalize access to knowledge for teachers, et cetera, then we have to create a lot of special programs to make up for the fact that we didn't have highly qualified teachers in every classroom. So we have dropout prevention programs and pregnancy prevention programs and compensatory education programs, and you name it, we have hundreds of programs. We also fund those programs in California, especially with a lot of categorical funding. In fact, Mike Kirst, my colleague, talks about the hardening of the categoricals. And that what that does is it also makes it inefficient for districts to be able to support what they need to make the decisions they need to make about where to put dollars to make the most difference. So there are 500 little pots of money. You know, none of them actually, in many cases, adequate to do the job. So you have $2.98 per kid towards an art program, which you actually can't even afford a full teacher at the end of the day. And you have a little bit of money for this and a little bit of money for that and all kinds of, you know, $10 a kid if they failed the exit exam to do something later for them because they didn't have expert, sophisticated teaching in the first place. That's nutty. And we do that over and over and over again in California. So that's another source of our inefficiencies. We have a factory model design in a lot of our schools still, and we have not yet in this state undertaken the concentrated effort to turn that around, to rethink and redesign schools so that they're more efficient and effective for most kids. So I think there are a number of places where we have to not only think about the amount of money we have, but also what is a sensible way to organize the spending of that money. So what can California do to close the achievement gap with federal help? And then I'm going to also talk about what we need to do without federal help. Let me point out that in the race to the top funds, which have been referenced, and I should have made a slide specifically on this because I realize that not everybody lives and breathes this as much as I do. But there are four things that states are being asked to do in the race to the top funds. And that's about a $4 billion pot of money that Secretary Duncan has available to encourage states to move in certain directions. And that includes raising teacher quality and closing the gap in the distribution of qualified teachers, number one. Number two, creating college and career-ready standards and assessments, moving towards really a set of standards and assessments that focus on what kids need to know and be able to do in the 21st century. Turning around low-performing schools and adopting strategies that are effective in doing that, and having data systems that allow us to track students and make good decisions. So those are the four things for the race to the top funds, and clearly there are policy elements of all those four. But there are even bigger pots of money than the race to the top funds that are available through the stimulus that are getting less discussion, and I want to point those out as well. There's a major investment in early childhood education and in preschool. $5 billion in the stimulus that will likely be added to. There will likely be a bill very shortly that calls upon states to create early learning councils that allow them to bring together their state preschool systems. I'll just leave it at that, if they have them, and the federal funds from Head Start and Early Head Start. There are a lot of things that need to be done to build that system of early learning, and we have a lot of evidence that that is actually one of the things that drives smaller achievement gaps, that drives improvements in achievement, particularly for the lowest achieving kids who don't get the learning opportunities before they get to kindergarten and leave us with a large achievement gap when kids are starting school. So that's one that needs to be on our minds. And we need to be strategic about that in California. There's a lot of money in Title I of the No Child Left Behind Act, soon to be renamed and reconfigured in some way. And that along with a school improvement grant fund that is about to be announced soon, will give states an opportunity to rethink how they spend money for professional development for teachers and for school leaders. And so there are lots of opportunities there to be much more strategic about being sure that we have the kind of programs that the woman who talked about QEIA recently, the kinds of programs that were put in place there that really do transform achievement. In general, what we have mandated from the state in recent years in terms of professional development has not organized the kind of learning opportunities for teachers that have been most effective. There is a tremendous allocation of funds, $6 billion for special education through IDEA. One of the big sources of the achievement gap is the lack of well-trained teachers to work with kids who learn in a wide range of ways and have serious learning needs. California's special education system, I will say, based on my experience across the country, is one of the least well-developed in terms of having a training system for people who are sophisticated and deep in their knowledge about how to work with kids who have special learning needs, both in the regular education classroom, where most of them are, 80% of special education kids are in the regular classroom, and in special day classes. We ask for less training from our teachers than any other state in the nation. In that regard, we offer fewer programs to get people ready to teach. We've infused less of the knowledge base that exists. We have in the Bay Area a tremendous problem with autism. We have very few teachers who are prepared to work effectively with those kids. There is going to be additional federal money for that. We should be organizing ourselves to take advantage of that as well. There's going to be a innovation fund to encourage states to develop new technology supports. The Hewlett Foundation is encouraging open resourcing, moving away from textbooks to online learning tools, for performance assessment and new school models. That's another $1 billion that will be open competitively. And there will be a bid or an RFP out there for states to join a performance assessment consortium to join with other states to develop new assessments. And I want to talk for a moment about that. Let me just say that having identified some of these, I pull on these because they are areas where we have some evidence that you can make a difference in achievement, and where California both has some successful programs going on that it could pay more attention to and scale up, and where we will have a lot of federal resources available for states that are thoughtful about accessing them. And we should, of course, try to position ourselves for Race to the Top funding, but a relatively small number of states are likely to access that funding. And so we shouldn't limit our vision only to that one way of thinking about what is needed. Back to New Jersey. I also wanted to talk about New Jersey as an example, and Matt has done a great job of doing that, so I'm not going to repeat what he said, but I'm going to point out to you that they have closed the achievement gap. They've cut the achievement gap in half with focused investment of funds, and I'm going to say in a moment what they did to achieve this, in addition to putting more money in high-need districts. California's average fourth-grade math achievement falls below that of African-American and Latino kids in New Jersey at this point. It did not 15 years ago, but that just gives us a sense of the kind of change that is possible. And I say that in a hopeful way because I think it's easy to get discouraged about what's possible. In New Jersey, they put in place statewide preschool, one of the highest quality preschool programs in the country. Within about 5 years, they trained up every single early childhood educator to have a bachelor's degree with an early childhood specialization. And they did that with very thoughtful, purposeful incentives. They just didn't monkey around. They got it done. They put in place a literacy program that Matt mentioned with literacy coaches and high-quality bilingual education in their high-need districts. They created new urban teacher education programs that train teachers well to teach in high-need communities with very sophisticated practices. They launched leadership development programs. While they were doing this, we were canceling in California all of the scholarship supports for teacher education. Our Leadership Academy that was the model for New Jersey's and other states' work. And they put in place, along with their graduation exam, a performance assessment component in their assessment system. So, again, being strategic about the uses of funds is really critically important. Let me close by suggesting that using federal dollars strategically, we would be able, with existing federal monies that are either in the pipeline or coming out in the coming months, to reinstate those subsidies for training teachers and leaders tied to retention in high-need communities, the TEACH grants, which are expanded, teacher quality partnerships. There is a California teacher performance assessment that was mandated by the CCTC requiring schools of education to evaluate with a performance assessment the ability of their candidates to teach. What a novel idea. And guess what? It's been just implemented this year for the first time. There's one version of it that 33 institutions, Stanford is one of those, is implementing, which requires teachers to plan a curriculum adapted to special needs students, English language learners, teach it, be videotaped, track and evaluate student learning. It actually drives improvements in candidate performance, ensuring that teachers come in with those skills that they need to have in the first days on the job. But it also completely leverages schools of education to say, if our candidates can't do these things, what are we going to do to change our programs? And as it's brought into accreditation, it will likely help us weed out those programs that shouldn't be trying to train teachers while driving improvements in the others. There is going to be there are resources that are likely to be available in the Innovation Fund to support that kind of work that California already has in place but has not yet funded, and which may go away if it isn't cultivated and supported. We can reallocate professional development funds to stronger models, and we can equalize, and this is something we have to do without necessarily federal support, but there will be federal encouragement, to equalize funding, make sure that the dollars follow the child and take account of pupil needs, and decategoricalize funding, which is my own word. But I think particularly in these times, there are some areas where you need categorical funds for special education students, for English language learner programs, to be sure they're following the child. But all of this other balkanization of the dollars that prevents districts from being able to focus on putting the dollars where they're needed to have high-quality teaching in every classroom is holding California back and is something that we can do with federal encouragement and with but we have to do it on our own. Finally, we need to think about this issue of curriculum and assessment. High-performing countries engage kids in not only a leaner curriculum, but science inquiries, research projects, extensive writing as part of their examination system, as part of their ongoing assessment system. There's going to be a call from the federal government because President Obama feels strongly that we need new assessments. We cannot get to 21st century skills by having kids bubble in multiple choice answers day in and day out. It's not a multiple choice world. And so there will be a request for states to band together to try to build new assessments to meet the new common assessment standards that are going to be announced in July. And that's an option for California to think about how to join with other states that have begun to do this to get a vision of what 21st century learning should be. Because if we spend our money as we solve our fiscal problems, which undoubtedly, we eventually will. But if we don't spend it on the right kind of learning, we will once again have created inefficiencies. What do I mean by this? One last point. This is an example of a traditional item on a U.S. test. This is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, 8th and 12th grade science. You've probably answered a lot of questions like this. I won't ask you to do a show of hands, but what two gases make up most of the Earth's atmosphere, A, B, C, D? This is an open-ended item on NAEP. I put that in quotes. Is a hamburger an example of stored energy? Explain why or why not. It's a simple yes or no question. The answer is yes. And there's a quick explanation. What are kids doing in other countries? This is the high school biology exam in Victoria, Australia. Kids are shown a virus and how it operates, and there's a little description of it. Then they're given a couple of pages of blank paper in which they answer the question, design a drug that will be effective against this virus, outline how it will prevent continuation of the cycle of reproduction, use diagrams. When they've finished answering that, they're asked to design an experiment to test the effectiveness of the drug. So this is what the standard really looks like when we talk about differential. And what the reason Australia happens to be one of the top 10 achieving states or countries in PISA on science and math literacy as well as reading and writing because they're writing all the time. So when we talk about international standards, this is what we're really talking about and the kind of learning that is going to be needed. At the end of the day, we'll need to be focusing both on the issues of equitable resources, but especially on how to reinstate the kind of teacher development and distribution system that will allow every kid to have a great teacher in their classroom every single year in every single subject. That has to be the framing of the goal. Nothing less than that is going to get us where we need to go. And there'll be a lot of federal potential support for that if we get organized. We need to focus on how to teach challenging content in a coherent curriculum using these kind of performance assessments. And then we need to take advantage of the innovation funds to think about how to redesign schools for student and teacher learning so that the response to schools that are struggling is not only here's another scripted curriculum to use more hours per day, but let's rethink the design. And we have a lot of successful examples in California to draw upon, and I appreciated your point about let's be sure we're paying attention to those as we take advantage of the resources that may come available. Thank you. I think we have time for a little questions. Yes. Yes.
Good morning, Linda.
Nice to see you. I feel like you're asking the wrong person the first question. And I wish Jack O'Connell were here or Arnold or someone who has a little more control over that. But I do think that it is going, first of all, I think people in the Department of Education are keenly aware of some of the issues that, and I hope they're keenly aware of all the range of possibilities. And I think that's something that a conversation should be started about. That is to say, people are so focused on Race to the Top, and I think that's a good thing. But there is so there is actually much more money, more likely to be allocated to more states in all of these other areas. And so we should be thinking about all of the above in terms of helping the governor and the State Department of Education be strategic in going after this. I can't speak to the politics, of what's going on this week, probably this moment in Sacramento as they're trying to work on the budget issue. I think a little prayer would be in order. Maybe we should have a moment of silence on behalf of our public officials. Yes, sir.
I'm Dan Lewis from Northwestern University, Professor of Education, and the politics issue I wanted to press you a little bit on, and the former speaker too. It's no accident that California is where it is on lots of these things. People voted to go in this direction. There were lots of propositions, and I mean, we all know that story. So, what's the scenario in which the politics would support the kind of goals and directions that you're talking about? And specifically, if and this audience is a good example, the voters in California are older white homeowners, and they're kind of dictating the direction of things in terms of who's getting elected and where the money is being spent, and we're talking about younger people of color who have less money is being affected by the distribution of resources. How do you change that scenario? What are the politics of, what are the new politics that get you to these goals?
I think that's a great question. And there was a public service advertisement a couple years ago in a community that reflects the demographics you just described. An older white population with relatively few kids in the schools now, voting on a tax levy, et cetera, et cetera. And they're a little, they did pictures of the kids, who were in the schools today. And they said, these are the kids whose wages will pay for your Social Security. How much education do you want them to get? Because the truth is, we had 20 workers for every person on Social Security in 1950. We have three potential workers for every person on Social Security in 2020. So, the notion that I got mine, sorry for you if you don't get yours, just doesn't work for us. The inner relationship, and I think Matt's presentation was really powerful in this regard, and I think it can also be made very personal to people. The money needed to support your health care, to support your Social Security, to support the things that you need is going to come from whether we have everyone in the labor market engaged in, first of all, in employment and not on the, in prison or on the welfare side of the equation, and making good wages and paying high taxes. So I think that case needs to be made much more effectively than it has typically been made. We haven't had that discussion. I think we're about to have a gubernatorial election, and anyone who is in any party, in any context, in any organizations ought to be talking to those candidates about these issues so that this becomes sort of the starting point for every candidate's conversations in those elections. You know, this is where we start, and then we may have a lot of ideas about strategy, but not about whether this is where we need to go. Yes, sir. Believe me, as someone who helped write the stimulus package for education, it was pitched that way. And in fact, there is. We were very fortunate in education to end up with over $100 billion in stimulus funds when the initial thinking back in the fall was maybe $5 billion for education. So it grew substantially, and this president is very strongly behind that. It is queued up. Part of what's going on now is really the very intensive work in the Department of Education right now just to get the RFPs out the door. But they have gotten quite a bit of it out the door already, and it will, you know, it will continue to... Well, $40 billion went out the door essentially that way, right away, and has already gone out the door. California was one of the first states in line to, you know, for that, and there's going to be another batch that does that. There are these issues, though, that you want to be sure that it actually preserves education funding and isn't just taken in by states and used for something else. So there is accountability that's needed. There's an effort to be sure that it really does supplement the education budget. And so, you know, that's been the process that I think folks have valiantly been undertaking in the department. And they're getting it out very quickly. You're going to see another basket of money coming out this fall. Several RFPs are going to hit the street in the next couple of months as well. Yes, in the very back. Hi. Yeah, you. There is a question about you know, the pads and all of that is kind of moving along. There's some language questions that have to get resolved about those linkages. I think that the links are possible, and there are a lot of discussions going on about that right now, both within the state and with the department. Yes.
Myself and my girlfriend in a credential program, most of my friends would give anything to leave their 9-to-5 and be a teacher. And this is, you know, top third of the college class. But for us, do you have any practical advice for that pool of people? Because we look at it and you can only take your moral obligations so far. When you talk about not being able to afford just a rental in the city you're teaching in, I mean, there's really practical implications, not to count if you have a mortgage, if you have other things. It's just not physically possible, even with a dual income, to rent a place, let alone own a place in that profession, where you have these people. We want to do this, and we just don't know how.
It's a great question. And there's some people in this room who've worked really hard on this issue. I'm looking at Ted Lemford and Chuck Weiss and others who have helped us earlier in California put in place a set of incentives for people to be able to, for example, get their training for free, to be able to get access to housing supports and subsidies in certain parts of the state, particularly in this area where housing is so precious and difficult to access. And so California actually has had a basket of policy strategies in the past that were productive in this regard. And could be reinstated. I mean, many of them hit the chopping block in the last 3 or 4 years. And so one thing we want on your behalf is for those incentives to be there so that you could prepare for free and not come out with debt. And, you know, I think part of it is all, you know, is that and have access to housing supports. And perhaps out of the ashes, the phoenix will rise with a more intentional approach. I would say for those of you, for young people who are interested, that there are many people have been made very nervous by the pink slipping this year, and you're probably among those. But this is one of California's pathologies. The jobs are coming back in a lot of districts now. They're beginning to realize what they can hire, you know, that they can hire, and so that people who have recently gone into teaching are going to be able to stay in the profession and continue to enter. I know that all of our graduates from the Stanford Teacher Education Program who were so nervous, you know, now have jobs for next year, and I think that's true in many, many places. So I think you have to be willing to make a gamble on the fact that this state will become more sensible in the future if you're interested in doing something like this now. There are a growing number of programs where you can train without taking on debt. There are a growing number of places where schools are redesigning to be great places for teachers to teach that are really organized so the kids can get to know their teachers well. Teachers can be in personalized environments with their kids. And then you have to join the ranks of those who see their work in public education not only as educating kids but educating the public about what's needed for a long-term, high-quality, supportive profession. John?
Picking up on a question from the earlier round, how would you balance the tension between involving local empowerment, parents' interest in supporting their local schools and local control, with the need to have a more centralized, even a nationalized education system?
That's a great question. And I think you have to think about what should be centralized and what should be decentralized in a system. We have it backwards. In most systems, and let me take Finland as an example, funding is centralized. Everybody, and this is true in most high-achieving countries, every school gets the same amount of money. There's more money for schools that serve high-need kids. We do it the reverse. We give less money to schools that serve high-need kids on top of the poverty they have. But then we tend to micromanage what they do because we, rather than investing in a high-quality teaching force and then letting them make decisions about how to manage what they do in the classroom, we underinvest in teachers and then try to micromanage what schools do. So the ed code in California is about this big, and Matt showed a contrast between Texas and California earlier. One of the interesting things Texas did is they sunsetted the education code. A few years back, and then they said, well, what do we need? And not every decision they made is, a decision I would necessarily agree with, but they really gave themselves the opportunity to rethink what's regulated. So I think what should be centralized is funding that should be equitable to start with. And I think most high-achieving nations have either national or state high-quality standards to guide the vision that schools are organizing around. Large countries tend to have state standards. In that list of top countries, China, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada all have state-level standards. Little countries like Finland and Singapore tend to have national standards, but they have some kind of focus on standards. And they support a thoughtful assessment system, which usually, in fact, in all of those countries, is not testing every kid every year with multiple choice tests. In most cases, they'll assess kids externally a couple of every third year, And then they have a rich assessment system inside the schools to guide teaching and learning and diagnosis and so on. But beyond that, a lot of the decisions are then made locally. So the decisions about how you manage the school to meet those standards, the decisions about how you spend your money to meet those standards are made by local educators. They have highly centralized investments in the teaching profession and the leadership of schools in the sense that everybody meets high standards and is well trained. But then they give them the autonomy to make decisions about what to do when they're in the classroom. And I think we've kind of done the reverse. We've sort of said, we don't trust you. We're going to micromanage everything you do. We're not investing in the knowledge base of the people who do the work. And we give you unequal money to work with. That's why we can't replicate good programs. We innovate a lot, but we don't build systems. So we innovate, we have great programs, we put money in, we do something special, and it works. But you can't take it to another district or another school if they don't have the resources and the trained staff who have the knowledge base to implement it. So until we get the level playing field of resources and human capacity, we can neither replicate good programs or give people the freedom to innovate further. So I think we have to think about centralization and decentralization with that notion that it's the capacity that has to be centralized, a vision of where we're going that needs to be guided, and then we need a lot more opportunity to make decisions at the local level. Yes. In New Jersey's case, they were sued over and over and over again by the Education Law Center of New Jersey for 30 years. I started student teaching in Camden, so I actually, my teaching career began at the beginning of that story where we had no textbooks in this high school, you know, no supplies, et cetera, so I watched that. And finally, in 1998, they agreed to put the money in these high-need districts that they'd been withholding for all these years. Now then, what did they but then they had a strategy about how to do that. And they, you know, the preschool, the literacy coaching, et cetera, et cetera. I think they had some enlightened leadership in the State Department of Education at that time. I know they did. And so they really began to think about what do we know that works and how can we make investments in that. They had some support from both Republican and Democratic governors over a period of time and were able to stay with a program rather than creating things and then killing them, which has been our hobby in California. You know, we've created all kinds of great programs and then it's like a yo-yo diet. Then they're gone, you know, 3 years later, just as they were beginning to work. So you need that consistency. I think I once studied the period of time in the 1990s when Connecticut had a very, very strong surge in commitment to rethinking teaching and in student achievement. They became the number one state in the nation by 1998 in most measures of student achievement. And there they had a commission. And this may be of interest to the Bay Area Council and others who are thinking about it. They had a statewide commission. They adopted a plan of action that was very systemic, very strategic, and they were able to bring on board the legislature. They were able to carry it through several governors of Democratic and Republican stripes, and they had a strong State Department of Education. No place has done this without a strong Ministry of Education, for example, in Finland, or a strong State Department of Education to, you know, be able to carry the work over a period of time. In Finland, they had hit the bottom. You know, they came out from under the Soviet Union's shadow, and they had a system which was heavily examination-based and tracked. So kids took exams all the time, and they were tracked into, like, 13 different tracks, and it was a very, very bureaucratic, tightly managed system. They kind of blew the whole thing up and started over, partly because of the political changes when the, you know, Soviet Union broke up and all of the influence of those prior policies was up for question. Yes.
My name is Anita Johnson. I'm a teacher. And you've made a good case that the inequality that exists in our country makes education very expensive. We have more homelessness, more poverty, more lack of health care than any of these other
countries. Well, I don't blame education for that. I think there are. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So when No Child Left Behind is rewritten, do you see that there's going to be a major push for an increase in funding to be able to do what these other countries do within our unequal system?
Yes, and that's already begun. President Obama, you know, made a promise, a pledge to fully fund No Child Left Behind or the new Elementary and Secondary Education Act or whatever it's called the next time around. That's already begun in the stimulus package with an additional $6 billion in funding this year and more continuing. But I don't think that's going to answer the problem because most of the inequality is driven at the state level. So the Title I money, the No Child Left Behind, adds maybe 10% to the budget. That's nice if it's organized in a way that is spendable for appropriate things. But it's not the big problem. The big problem is that states have to look at the inequality that has been embedded in their way of funding schools for 200 years and bite that bullet and fix it. As I say, in New Jersey, it took 30 years of litigation. Maybe it will take fewer years of litigation here. Maybe a constitutional convention will bring us a new funding scheme, a new revenue scheme, a weighted student formula approach that sends dollars to kids attached to student needs. But that's going to have to be done at the state level. The federal government may encourage that by asking states to demonstrate that they are making progress towards equity in their funding as part of what is tied to federal dollars, but states are going to have to do that for themselves. And they're going to have to make the argument, I think Matt helped us start to make, that this matters for everyone, that everyone's well-being is tied to every child's high-quality education. And I just got the high sign, so that's a good place to stop.
Okay, thank you so much, Linda. That's a phenomenal presentation, and Matt as well. And the two obviously dovetailed so well together. As I listened to the questions that came out, they sort of grouped into two categories, which are the typical two questions that arise. And the first one is, the system as we have it, doesn't it require tremendous reform? Are we anywhere nearly close to the level of efficiency and capability and quality that we need in order to be competitive and address the achievement gap? And I think the general answer you've seen from these presentations, without question, is yes. The system needs tremendous reform. It needs to be updated. We need a 21st century system. The second question that comes up just as much don't we need more money? Are we, you know, is there any reasonable, you know, isn't it a reasonable expectation that in order to get where we need to go, we're going to need to invest in this new system? And the answer to that is also yes. There's no way we're going to be able to provide the training to teachers or the early childhood education profession to improve school facilities, to provide the proper equipment and so forth, and reduce class size where need be and all these things without making major, major new investments in the system. So question was asked, well, how did New Jersey or Finland and others build the consensus necessary to be able to move forward? And clearly, you know, from we need to do that within a California context because California is a it's not a country, it's a state, and it's very, very large, and it's very, very diverse. It's an incredibly diverse place. And so here's what we're thinking. What we're thinking is what we can do and what you need to help us do, if you agree, is we need to drive a consensus starting now between those who see the solution primarily as investing more in the system, and we think they're right, with those who believe that the system needs magnificent new reform, and we think they're right, too. as you watch these presentations, you know, between the getting down to fact study that Stanford led, you know, not very long ago in voluminous study on reforming K-12 in California, to the we did have a state commission, Governor's Commission on Education Excellence, which made very similar kinds of recommendations. We probably don't need too many more studies on what to do. In fact, I think everybody could see today, and your presentation, you know, hits it on the mark. We know what to do. The question is how to get there. And so what we're going to try to do is build a consensus between what are effectively two factions, that we need to reform it now and not another dollar goes into the system until we see the reform faction, to we're not going to reform anything until you give us the money, because basically what we need is the money and then we'll perform. And we're going to try to be participant with Ted and Children Now and Phil Halpern in the Silver Giving Foundation and other groups, and with labor and with our greater business community. What we're going to try to do over the next couple of years is build a consensus to come together with these two ideas, that it's going to take a combination of resources and a willingness to undergo significant, major reform, bring those things together in order to move forward and build a consensus, and so that we can come back. You know, I think all of us are tired. I heard that, too. We're tired of seeing the same old data that demonstrates that California has fallen at or near the bottom of the heap. And we want to start seeing some presentations in a few years that show that trend reversing and California regaining its rightful place at the top of the heap. And only that will work. We have to have an absolute commitment to regaining that leadership here in California and nationally, or we're not going to succeed, and it's going to affect, unfortunately, our kids much more than it affects us. So I want to thank you. I want to leave you with that. Thank you very, very much for these wonderful presentations, eye-opening presentations. My vacation is officially over. You have ended any fun I was having. And we'll be in touch with you, and we urge your continued awareness and support and participation for the work that we're doing, and especially your input and advice. So thank you, and to the Commonwealth Club for having us and supporting this presentation today. Thank you very, very much, Chairman Mendoza. We stand adjourned. Thank you.